Okay. I want to explain what I mean by partial unconditionality. I would like to explain this by giving some results. One result was shown by Ted, and it says the following. If you have any normalized weakly null sequence and you give yourself any epsilon, then... sorry, am I in the way? Down? Okay. So this is a result of Ted. You give yourself a normalized weakly null sequence and you give yourself an epsilon, then you always can find a subsequence so that you can project on the finite dimensional spaces Zi coming out of an E, if E is a so-called Schreier 1 set, meaning it's a type of a finite subset which has the property that if the minimum is n, it only has not more than n elements. Or in other words, you only have, if the first, it starts with n, it only has n after n places. Yeah. And so then if you have such a set, you can always project up to the projection of such a, the norm of such a projection is only always smaller than 2 plus epsilon, and if the basis sequence you started with was bimonotone, it would be 1 plus epsilon. This is the type. So in other words, you can project on certain sets. This is one type of partial inconditionality. The other type is a result of Argyros, Merkourakis, and I never can pronounce it, Zarpalias, and it says the following. It was already mentioned by Ted before. I'm kind of stating it differently. So you also start with a normalized weakly null sequence, and you start with an epsilon and a constant bigger than 1. Then you find a subsequence so that the projections on the subspace is generated by E is smaller than C plus epsilon if E is in the set of finite subsets on which the finite sequence ZE, E coming out of the set, I coming out of the set E, is C equivalent to the little L1 space on E. So you can, roughly speaking, you can, after passing to a subsequence, you can project on little L1 spaces. Okay. Now, of course, if you are an optimist, a complete optimist, you ask yourself, why is this theorem true? And you hope, and the best possible hope, the biggest hope you would have, it's true because you're actually projecting on spaces which have a one unconditional basis, which have an unconditional basis themselves. So, you might hope for the following type of generalization. So, I state it as a question. The question is like following. Under which condition? You have the same assumption, Xn being a normalized weakly null sequence, and you ask yourself, under which condition you can pass to a subsequence or maybe block sequence, so that you conclude that the projection on E only depends, the projection on some sets E only projects, only depends on the so-called inner unconditionally constant, meaning on, you look at the projections from E to subsets F, and you take the supremum over all norms. Now, unfortunately, okay, now you could, for example, ask, can Argyros, Merkourakis, and Zarpalias results generalize in this direction? So the first answer is no. Like, for example, you could ask, could in the statement L1, could this be replaced by L2, for example? And there's an example by Ted, and I'm a little bit embarrassed to say, Ted faxed me this example a couple of months ago, well, actually maybe a year ago, and I wanted to look at it, and I couldn't find it anymore, and I cannot reconstruct it. But at one point in my life, I saw an example, and it seemed to be correct. If I remember well, it was an example based on Murray Rosenthal. This is, I think, so. Okay, so in general, you cannot replace little L1 by other spaces with unconditioned bases, but, and this is a main result in my talk, you can prove something else. So, let me state now a result in maybe in a vague language, and I hope that during my talk I will be able to make everything precise in the statement. So, Ted introduced a moment ago these games of Gowers, where one player chooses block spaces, the other player chooses elements out of these block spaces. Now, this is the following assumption: that space chooser, in the sense of this game of Gower, can force the resulting sequence to be C unconditional. This is my assumption. But in a game which is restricted in length, I will introduce for each alpha smaller than omega 1, for each countable omega, what I call a game of length alpha. So your assumption is that the space chooser can always force the resulting finite sequence to be C unconditional in a game of length alpha. This implies, this was also introduced by Ted, he introduced asymptotic structure, which was for finite ordinals, introduced by Murray Millman and Nicole Tomczak-Jegermann, and I will kind of generalize this notion for general alpha. And so this will imply that this, okay, you can think of asymptotic structures also be a result of a game, but in which the space chooser can only choose special spaces, namely specials of finite codimension, or what I would call tail spaces, spaces which are generated from 1n on. So, this will imply, the first fact will imply that the space chooser also has a winning strategy, even if he only can choose tail spaces, but on a subspace. And this implies that there is a block space of X so that for all further block spaces, you can project on subspaces, on finite subspaces, which are generated by, I'm using a term which I have to explain later, but for the specialists who know this, by alpha admissible blocks. And alpha admissible in the sense of the fine Schreier sets, which I also have to define later. So, but roughly speaking, we kind of will end up under certain hypotheses, which I have to explain, we will end up to prove that you can always project on certain subspaces of certain size, where the size depends how close your space is to unconditionality. This is roughly speaking, but I have to, there's a lot of things which I have to explain before I... Okay. So let me recall, I want to let me recall Gower's theorem, and I will need some notations for that. I will call by sigma f of x all finite normalized block sequences. All block sequences, and block sequence are simply sequences of vector whose support is one after another. Right? So I make here the precise definition. I typically write, this is also very usual, that x1 is smaller than x2 if the minimum of the support of x2 is bigger than the maximum of the support of x1. Then if I say that a block space is simply a subspace generated by an infinite block sequence, and I'm writing this sequence, y is smaller than x. And I give myself a sigma, which is a subset of the set of all normalized of all finite normalized blocks, and I simply assume it's hereditary in the sense that if I cut off a block which is in sigma, I still stay in sigma. So it's hereditary from the right. Okay. Now, let me state Gower's theorem now. Let me recall the gain first. So, which Ted did already. So we're looking at the gain between two people who I call S and P, S for subspace chooser and P for point chooser. And the gain goes like this. S chooses a block space Y1. P chooses an element of the sphere of Y1. And then S chooses against another block, and so on. So this game goes forever. And okay, there's one little difference in the statement of to Gower's original theorem. I'm viewing everything from the point of view of the space chooser. Like in Gower's work, it was more seen from this point of view of the point chooser. So I'm always thinking of being myself the space chooser. So I'm saying that the what?
You're on the winning side.
No, of course I want to think, when do I have a winning strategy, right? I mean, this is my person. I have to. Okay. So now, and I'm saying, so they play this game infinitely often, infinitely long, and the space chooser wins if for at any time the sequence y1, y2, yn stays in sigma. So this is means that S wins. Now, then there's a little notation I need because we're doing combinatorics and analysis together, so we always need epsilons, right? We always have to fatten it up. And if you have a sequence of epsilon i's, which are positive numbers, I'm calling sigma epsilon the epsilon fattening of my set sigma, simply the sequence of all x1, xn for which there exists an y1, yn, which is for which every xi is epsilon I close to yi. So this is what I call epsilon fattening. So with this, you can now state the theorem in the following way. That assuming, so that the following two conditions are equivalent. The space chooser has a winning strategy on all block spaces for all fattenings of sigma. This is equivalent with saying that on all block spaces and on all sequences epsilons, there exists a further subspace so that the finite blocks on Z are contained in the epsilon fattening of sigma. Okay? So this is the statement. And why is this equivalent to Gower's statement? Simply because all these games are determined. So in other words, whenever S has a winning strategy, S has a winning strategy if and only if P has not a winning strategy, and vice versa. This is why you can formulate every result on winning strategies for S in a result on winning strategies for P. Now, what you can interpret this result in the following way. It's kind of trivial that B implies trivially A. Right? This is trivial. Now, what it really says is the following. If S has a winning strategy, assuming that S has a winning strategy on all subspaces, then S actually has a very simple strategy. In other words, B tells you that actually the space chooser can do, at the beginning of the game, he finds the subspace Z and stays with it. Well, stays with it, he always has to take the tail space of Z. Right? And then you see already the... In other words, he can go home and simply let the computer choose his Z, in some sense, his response. Okay, now... this is Gower's game. Now let me explain what I mean by restricting the length of the game. So for all, and this is something, yeah, I will mention later what exactly, what it was already considered by Roy Wagner, Alpha Games. But I'm defining it slightly different because I want a certain result, so I have to define alpha games in a different way than Roy, but very similar. Okay. I will define for all alpha what an alpha game is. Well, the zero game is pretty easy. S wins if the empty set is in sigma. That's it. So in other words, if sigma is not empty. Okay. Now, assuming I know what an alpha game is, I can tell you what an alpha plus one game is. Well, it simply means that X picks a block space, P picks a vector in the block space, and then they play an alpha game, but for sigma restricted to Y, in other words, for all the little sigmas which concatenated with Y give you something in sigma. Well, this is a natural thing, right? I mean, it makes sense. This is the and for limit ordinals, and here I make a little... I make a difference to what Roy defines it in the limit ordinal case. In the limit ordinal case, S picks a beta, an ordinal beta smaller than alpha. Then Y picks a beta prime between beta and alpha. And then they play a beta prime game. So in other words, both players can make the beta prime as big as they want, right? I mean, S by picking the lower bar beta, and P by choosing anything between beta and alpha. So, and then they play a beta prime game. Well, without loss of generality, you can always assume that the beta prime is a successor ordinal, because if it were a limit ordinal again, they make this choice again. So until they start picking vectors and spaces once they reach a successor ordinal. Now, then you can actually, the result of an alpha game is then simply a sequence, a finite sequence. This game, this is important, it's easy to notice that such a game always ends after finite many steps, even if you cannot predict the number of steps at the beginning. But this is simply because every decreasing sequence of ordinals is finite, right? This is the thing. And the result of an alpha game will be always a finite sequence of vectors, which I block, and I kind of want to index them by ordinals, by a decreasing number of ordinals. So So, for example, if you choose an alpha, if alpha is a limit ordinal, my first ordinal will be the beta prime. If beta prime is a successor ordinal, the next ordinal will be beta prime minus 1 and beta prime minus 2 and so on until you arrive at an ordinal, then there will be another beta prime and so on. So I can think of the result of a game being a family of x beta, where beta comes out of an index set I. I is a subset of alpha and has the property whenever alpha is a successor ordinal, the predecessor has to be an I. Secondly, if for any successor ordinal, the predecessor has to be an I. And in it's like reverse. If gamma is smaller than beta in I, x gamma has to be smaller than x beta. So this is what I think of being a result of an alpha game. Okay, and as I remarked before, Wagner defined it slightly different. He defines limit ordinal in the limit ordinal case. F picks a beta and a block space. And then P picks a beta prime and a vector. And this corresponds more to the what I'm calling an alpha plus one game, but not exactly. But the reason why I defined it different is because I want to show the following result, which corresponds to like a quantitative version of Gower's result. Well, I first have to okay. Before I do this, I first have to tell you what. Okay, remember. Let me see. Where's Gower's result? Yeah. Okay. Every sigma, so that if you concatenate it with y, you get something in sigma. Think of alpha being a finite number, like 17. Of course, if you want to win the game of 17, you have to make sure that you pick. It's hard to explain, but this is your goal, right? You want after the first step, you want to win that game, right? Make sense? Let me remind you. I first have to define in what. So now the game we're playing now an alpha game, which is kind of easier for the subspace chooser, because an alpha game eventually ends, while a Gower's game never ends. So we have to. So I have to tell you by what we have to replace the set of all finite blocks. And it's kind of also very natural. There's one thing which is never natural, but okay. So what I call an alpha admissible, what I call the set of all alpha admissible blocks is the following. I have to choose in advance a limit ordinal alpha. For any limit ordinal alpha, I have to choose a sequence which increases to alpha. This is following an idea which goes back, I think, to Spiros, Agios, and Dale Alsbach when they defined Schreier sets of higher order thing. And once I have chosen, so I have to fix this from the beginning on for each alpha a sequence which converges to alpha. Then, well, sigma 0 of x is simply the contains the empty set. Assuming I define sigma alpha, well, it's simply the set of all x comma sigma concatenated, where x is anything in the sphere with finite support, and I'm putting a something out of sigma alpha behind. And since I want to have everything hereditary, I want I have to put the empty set again back there. So, and for limit ordinal, I'm using this sequence to define diagonalization. So, for limit ordinal, sigma alpha. I should forget this here. I have it twice here, so forget the union here. It's a set of all finite blocks which have the property that for some n which is smaller than the minimum of the support of the first element of sigma, sigma is in sigma of gamma alpha n, of the nth element of the sequence converging to alpha. Right? So this is my, what I call sigma alpha admissible, what I call alpha admissible, and in a way, there's this, it's alpha admissible respect to the so-called fine Schreier sets, and I will introduce this later. Okay, so assuming we have, now I can state the result. The following are equivalent, and so you can compare to Gauss' result, is exactly the right correspondence, that the space chooser has a winning strategy on all subspaces for all epsilon fattenings of sigma, if and only if, for all block spaces X and for all epsilons, there exists a further subspace so that the alpha admissible blocks are subset of the epsilon fattening. So this is the, and where, okay, I'm defining, of course, where this is simply relativity to Z. I mean, a sigma alpha Z is simply, you replace the basis of X by the basis of Z, and that's, you get the same, okay? So you see the correspondence. And I will give you a quite easy proof of that theorem, and I also will show you that Gauer's theorem can be thought of the limit case. So that theorem 3 could be seen as the limit case of theorem 4. Okay, so let me sketch the proof. It's quite easy. The easy direction, as you might guess, is the direction from B to A. There's only one thing you have to notice is, although these family sigma alphas are not increasing with alpha, you cannot expect this because of your diagonalization all the time, but it's true up to finite dimensional, finite dimensional block. So what you can say, if you have an alpha which is smaller than a beta, the sigma alpha for a tail space is contained in the sigma beta of the same tail space. You have to pass to a tail space. It's very easy to prove. You prove this by transparent induction. There's no problem. So now let's assume B is correct of theorem 4. Well, what I have to tell you, what is the strategy of the space chooser to have a winning strategy? It's very simple. Well, S has to choose a beta, and the only non-trivial case is if alpha is a limit ordinal, right? And well, S takes an arbitrary beta, P has chosen a beta prime, S has then to choose an M so that the gamma alpha M is strictly bigger than beta, or bigger or equal than beta prime, and then he can choose by proposition 5, can choose the right tail space of Z. You can choose the right tail space of Z, namely the one so that sigma beta prime is contained in sigma gamma alpha M, and sigma gamma alpha M after the nth place is of course contained in sigma alpha by the definition, by the very definition. So this is no problem. Now the other direction is a little bit harder, but actually also not too hard. And it's very, the only non-trivial case, if you think about it, so we're proving the theorem by transfinite induction, and the only non-trivial induction step is the step from alpha to alpha plus 1. I mean, the rest is simply write down. There's no problem. Now, and the proof goes along the lines of the heart of the Galvin-Pritchard proof, like all the other proofs. So you start with your arbitrary epsilon bar sequence, and I define the delta bar to be the shifted sequence. Okay. So fix for the moment block space Y. And take an element out of the sphere of Y. Then you have two possibilities. Right? Either there exists a subspace of Y on which P has a winning strategy for the game, for the alpha game, for the sigmas which start with Y. For this game. Right? Okay. Or this is not true. Okay. Let's negate this phrase. Well, the negation of this phrase for all Z block space of Y, the space chooser has a winning strategy in the alpha game for that sigma. But now we assume we have already proven the equivalence of theorem 4 for alpha. This means, so you go from here to here, you have this condition. So this means, then, by our induction hypothesis, we find a Z so that the alpha admissible blocks on Z are subspace of the delta fattening of this animal there. Okay? This is simply by using the induction hypothesis. So in other words, we have the alternative, and either there's a Z which does this, or we have a Z which does that. Right? I mean, we have this thing. Okay, now we iterate this. We iterate this, and starting with any Y1, and then we iterate this by getting Y1 smaller than Y2, smaller than Yn. So, and we get a sequence of block sequence, one contained in the other, so that, well, Yn is always in the previous block sequence, so that for an epsilon 1 over 2 net, this is only technically for a certain finite epsilon net, we have, again, this alternative, that either P has a winning strategy on Zn plus 1 in an alpha game, or this does not happen, then by the induction hypothesis, Z alpha, the alpha admissible blocks of Zn plus 1 are contained in this delta fattening. Right? This is simply by using the previous argument over and over again. Now, and this is now the usual argument, if you make the fattening a little bit fatter, instead of using a finite net, you have the whole closure, right? I mean, this is the typical argument. So we conclude that actually we can say if we take Z to be the block space generated by all these Yn's, which is like the diagonal sequence of all the Zn's in some sense, we can say that for all Y, there exists a Z, namely the Z which was constructed before, which has the following property, that for all Y and Z, either P has a winning strategy in the game for sigma epsilon block over 2 restricted to Y. I want to remind you, P wants to get to the complement of sigma. He wants to get in the complement. So by making this neighborhood smaller, I make the complement bigger. So this I take care, this is how I take care of from replacing the finite set by the whole set. Okay? And the other alternative is that sigma, that the admissible sets of Z starting after Y. Recall that this is actually contained in Zn plus 1, where n is the maximum of the support of Y, is contained in this delta fattening where I replace epsilon by 2 epsilon. Also make it fatter. Okay, so now, I'm arguing. Okay, for the moment we didn't do anything and we haven't used our hypothesis yet. Now I'm arguing. So I have defined for every Z, for every Y, for every block space Y, it's further block space Z. Now I'm arguing that actually, for all Y in X, there exists a block space of ZY, so that for all W in this space, case 2 happens. So in other words, on a subspace of Z, only case 2 has to happen. Well, it's also easy to see, because what does it mean it does not happen? Assuming that what I'm saying is wrong, this would mean that there is some y naught, so that for all w in zy naught, there exists a y, so that case 1 happens. But if you think about this, what does it mean? It means on that, it means for no matter, let's think about the gain restricted to this space. It means that no matter what the subspace chooser chooses, the point chooser always has an answer to have a winning strategy. Which means, in other words, the point chooser has a winning strategy for the game alpha plus 1. But this is a contradiction to our assumption. So this cannot happen. So we have this case. We know that this is true. Okay, and now you write down what this means. Now you remember what the definition of sigma alpha plus 1 on the space W was. You take for the moment the empty set out. So this is simply the set of all W comma sigma, where W is in the sphere of W, and sigma is in capital sigma alpha. And this is from what we proved is a subset of this, which is then now because of the right choice of the delta was the shifted epsilon, it's simply contained in sigma 3 times epsilon bar. Now replacing epsilon bar by epsilon bar with a third, we have it. So this proves the theorem. Okay. So there's actually... Yeah, before I go on, let me remark that theorem 3, Gower's theorem, is in a way that can be seen of the limit case of theorem 4. What you need the little lemma, you need the following little lemma, which is not hard to show. You can show that if for all block spaces, if you have your set sigma, capital sigma, and you know that for all block spaces and for all alpha smaller than omega 1, there is some further block space so that sigma alpha of Z, there's a Z missing, so that sigma alpha of Z is subspace of sigma. Then there is also for all block spaces a further block spaces so that all finite blocks are in sigma. In a sense, if you take all Schreier sets, you get all finite subsets. This is kind of the same argument. So using this lemma, you can easily deduce now Gower's theorem, because if F has a winning strategy in Gower's game, he of course has a winning strategy for all alphas. This means for all alphas, this is true, and you imply this. So this is. So it also, okay, Gower actually formulated his gains also for infinite, of subsets of infinite blocks. And he proves it actually to be true whenever sigma is analytic, right? Analytic with respect to the product topology. But, okay, I cannot prove this. The only thing I can show is that I can deduce from theorem 4 Gower's theorem for infinite blocks, as long as the sigma is closed under the product of the discrete topology. So I don't think I can go further. And this simply because I am applying the theorem 4 to the finite blocks for which F has a winning strategy. Right, okay, so, but I mean, it's not very hard to see that that theorem 4 implies the theorem of Gauss of whenever sigma is closed, but not further than that. It doesn't go further. I don't think it goes further. Okay, now let's go back to the problem of partial unconditionality. I also spoke in the statement, in this kind of vague statement, I also spoke about fine Schreier sets. Let me define them. And there's a natural connection between fine Schreier sets and alpha admissibility. I'm defining certain subsets of all finite subsets of the positive integers. And F0 is simply the set container which only contains the empty set. And assuming I defined F alpha plus 1 is simply the concatenation of a singleton with an element out of F alpha. And I allow the empty set still in it. I want to make it hereditary. Okay? Now, in the limit ordinal, I do something similar. If I'm using the same sequence which approximates the limit ordinal alpha, and then F alpha is the set of all finite subsets so that there is some set smaller than the minimum of E, so that E is in F gamma alpha n. So kind of a diagonal set. And for people who know what the Schreier sets in, the alpha Schreier sets corresponds to, it's actually philosophically equal to the set F of omega to the power alpha. Philosophically equal means that actually the Cantor-Bendixson index is on all subsets of N the same. But it's, strictly speaking, is not the same. But okay. It could be the same if you define the gamma, the gammas the right way. Right. Yeah. So now, and there's actually a very simple connection between alpha admissibility and the set F alpha. It simply means a block is in sigma alpha if the finite sequence consisting out of the minimum of the supports are in F alpha. Actually, in most works, it's defined the other way around. The sigma admissibility is defined via the F alphas, but I wanted to do this later. Okay. So this is the fine Schreier set. Now I can state my result on the partial unconditionality in a more precise way. So I assume that X has a bimonotone basis. This is, I mean, every Banach space with a basis has up to some renorming. The basis can always be renormed to be bimonotone. This is not a big problem. Now, and assume that for some alpha smaller than omega 1, the space chooser has a winning strategy in the alpha game where sigma is the set of all unconditional blocks, but of all inner unconditional blocks, and taking the set of all blocks so that projecting on subsets, you get the projection doesn't exceed more than a constant C. Right? So if you take the blocks, the finite blocks which have inner unconditionality not larger than C. Okay? Then the conclusion is there exists a block space Z so that for all further block spaces W, the projection on finite basis generated by Wi, I coming out of a set E, is of norm smaller than 2 times C, the constant will be doubled, if E satisfies the property that the minima of the supremums of W is an F alpha set. By the way, so it's a little bit more general than saying E is an alpha set. But up to a result of Androulakis and Odell, it's almost the same. But it's more general than saying that E is an F alpha set, right? But So this is the theorem I would like to prove, and now it kind of follows now quite easily from theorem 4. I need a little proposition before I can start. The little proposition is the following thing. I'm kind of look at sigma alpha, and I'm doubling sigma alpha. So I'm taking a sigma alpha block, and I put another sigma alpha block in between. Right? This is what I mean by a sigma alpha square. Right? I'm taking all the blocks so that every second one, if I pick every second one, is a sigma alpha block. Then this is almost, so what the proposition says, this is almost up to changing the gammas, the approximating sequence, the same as sigma alpha itself, at least if alpha is a limit or no. So to say it exactly is that we can find for each limit ordinal another approximating sequence, gamma alpha n, leading to kind of other admissible blocks, sigma tilde alphas, so that whenever we have alpha smaller than omega 1, this should be omega 1, of course we always can write any ordinal as a limit ordinal plus an integer, plus a positive integer, then my sigma alpha square of x, which is nothing else, the concatenation of a sigma and a tau, where the sigma simply has cardinality k, where k is like the integer part of alpha. In particular, if k is zero, so if, in other words, if alpha is a limit ordinal, sigma alpha square is contained in sigma alpha tilde. And this is pretty easy because what you're simply doing is if sigma alpha k is of the form if sigma alpha n, beta alpha n plus kn, where this is the limit ordinal, what you're simply doing, your tilde is simply, you double the integer part. This is very simple. So, and this is then, you can easily prove this by induction. But in particular, this implies if my sigma alpha, if my tilde admissible blocks are contained in all the blocks which are C unconditional in the sense of inner unconditionality, then my square is contained in the same by taking the constant by 2. Simply because it is a simple fact. If I have a block which is C unconditional and another block which is also C unconditional, and one is after another, the unconditionally constant only becomes 2 times the constant. It only doubles at most. So this is a simple observation. And once I did this observation, then you can use the theorem. Okay, so now we have this assumption on the winning strategy. This means that we can apply our theorem 4. So we can apply our theorem 4, but for the tilde admissible sets, which doesn't, you see, it's kind of in theorem 4, it doesn't really matter. The truth of theorem 4 doesn't change which of the approximating sequence you take for the limit ordinals. Right? I mean, it's independent of the approximating sequences, so it doesn't matter. So I can take as well using sigma tilde as my reference family. So I find a block space Z, so that sigma alpha tilde of Z is contained in the set of blocks which are C unconditional, which means by my previous little argument that the sigma square of alpha is contained in the blocks which are 2 C unconditional. And now I'm claiming that Z is the right space. Why? Take any block space of any block space W, which generated by WNs, and I want to project on some set E for which the minimum of the supports are contained in F alpha. So what I'm arguing is now the following. One way to think of the projection constant, norm of the projection is this way. Your E is something like this. E is N1, N2, NK, right? So this is now your WN1, your WN2, and here your WN3. But there might be space in between. So this is your E, your first element of E, your second element of E. One way to think of the projection constant, that 1 over the norm of the projection is the infimum of all of the norm of all vectors of the form W plus Y, where W is in the span of the E and has norm 1, and the Y sits in between. So in other words, I'm asking to add Y's here in between so that the total norm gets as small as possible. Right? This is one way. It's very easy to see that this is exactly the same as 1 over PE. So now, but of course, now the point is that if you take the sequence of the W's and the YI's together, they actually are now a sequence of sigma square, for which I have 2 C unconditionality by my previous choice. So I have, this is bigger or equal 1 over 2c. So this proves the theorem. I have a little couple of minutes. I didn't say any, so I actually, let me go, the theorem I promised and was something of the following form. Let me recall. In a way, I skipped the middle part for the moment. I told you something about how the space chooser having a winning strategy implies a result like that. Now, where do asymptotic structure come in? Well, the theorem tells you that actually one way to interpret the theorem is that for the space chooser to have a winning strategy on all y's, this implies he also has a winning strategy on some subspace when his hands are tied behind his back and he only can choose tail spaces, right? And there where asymptotic structure comes in. Let me recall the definition by Murray, Milman, and Tomczak Jägermann. Since I defined all these games, it's now easy to define it like a result of a game. I say E is in the asymptotic structure, and E is simply a finite n-dimensional space with a norm on it, and where the vectors are always normalized, if and only if the point chooser can force in a game of length n to get arbitrarily close the block space, the block which is true, to get arbitrarily close to E, assuming the space chooser only can choose tail spaces. This is one way to think of asymptotic structure. Now, using now from the theorem, there's now a natural way to generalize asymptotic structure to alpha asymptotic structure, and instead of looking at all normalized spaces of dimension n, I'm looking at all spaces, normed spaces on which you have a basis of length alpha. It's like a transfinite basis. So it's like a norm on C00 on alpha. So now you can say that E is in the asymptotic structure of X of order alpha. Now it's a little, I have to get a little bit vague because the things have to be, if it's pointwise true. Okay. If point user can force in an alpha game the space for any finite I, so projecting for any finite I, he can make the finite result in Banach-Mazur distance close to the corresponding finite dimensional subspace of E. Okay. Okay, let me tell you why I looked at that. My goal, and unfortunately this is a goal I didn't accomplish. My goal was to say something about spreading models. And my goal was, my hope was, in order to analyze asymptotic structures of higher complexity, this might tell me something about spreading models. Unfortunately, no. The answer, well, at least for the moment, and I'm quite sure that unfortunately it doesn't tell me anything, simply because even asymptotic structure of high ordinals is still too finite dimensional. You see, spreading models really lie between exactly between infinite and finite dimension, while asymptotic structure is more on the finite dimensional side. And I couldn't see, but of course, okay, so this is my last slide. We could, what you can, as if you want to, as I said, I always want to see things from the space chooser. You can also think of the asymptotic structure, of the alpha asymptotic structure to be the intersection of all compact sets of your set of all norms on C0 alpha on which S has a winning strategy. This is the other way to think of asymptotic structure. And then you simply have, by theorem 4, you have, if space chooser using general subspaces has a winning strategy, he also has a winning strategy on if he only is allowed to choose block spaces on a block space, on a certain block space. Okay, so this finished my talk.